Welcome to the Mind-Muscle Connection Podcast, a show that is dedicated to educating you on applying science-based training, nutrition, and mindset strategies from some of the top minds in the industry to help you build a leaner, stronger, and more confident self. I'm your host, Jeff Hain. Let's dive in. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Mind Muscle Connection Podcast. And today I have a special guest, Menno Henselman. He is back on for the third time. So Menno, welcome back on.
My pleasure.
So I think last time we talked, I think you were in Mexico, I believe. And I always, every time you come on, I like to ask you, where in the world is Menno?
Currently, I'm in Lisbon, Portugal.
Awesome. Is that kind of a regular place for you? Is this the first time you've been there?
I've been here a few times, and I've lived here now for about 3 months. So it's a relatively long stay. I like it. I like Portugal and Brazil in general. And I can get by with Portuguese, although here in Lisbon, everyone speaks English pretty much. So you don't really need to. But it's nice. Nice atmosphere. Great sushi, which is my favorite. Just very tranquilo and nice place to live.
Awesome. So I'm a big sushi guy myself. What's like your go-to rolls? Do you have any like that, or is it just kind of anything? Or yeah, what does that look like?
I like it very traditional. So lots of fish, not too much fusion stuff. I do like salmon avocado a lot. I think that's a great combination. And I make my own sauces with sucralose. So I always bring sucralose and use it in soy sauce to make sweet soy sauce. And I like unagi sauce. And it adds a little more sweetener to that as well. So you only need a tiny little bit. You can get pretty creative.
Yeah, that's a cool thing with sushi. There's so many things. I feel like probably for a lot of people, that's where, you know, sushi can add up in terms of calories. Is you kind of mentioned that you add your own sauce. And I'm assuming that's probably just to kind of watch, make sure they don't add a ton of calories. Or is that just kind of preference in terms of like just the taste of it? Or is there like maybe gut issues there with you? Or yeah, what does that look like? Or is it just, yeah, just because, you know, you are in more control of the calories? Cause I feel like for most sushi, if you get like a roll or something like that, that's probably where they can really start to add up in terms of calories is the sauces that they put on there.
Both for me. So most of what I eat is simply soy sauce with sucralose. So, and then it becomes sweet soy sauce, but it's still almost zero calorie and you need very little because it's very strong in taste. So I don't think I consume a lot of calories from the sauce. If you have like mayonnaise or, you know, cream, those kind of things on the fusion rolls, that racks up calories a whole lot faster indeed.
Yeah, I guess what would you consider fusion? Is that like kind of the crazy roll, like these like insane rolls that they have that just have all kinds of toppings? Is that what would be considered fusion?
Yeah, that's definitely fusion. Traditional is basically rice, fish, soy sauce, and you know, it doesn't get much crazier than tamago. So the egg roll or the egg nigiri, maki, tamaki, gunkan. Rolls are mostly simply maki. Like California is already technically fusion.
Interesting. Yeah, those are usually the pretty popular ones. I feel like over here in the States, the fusion ones, but those are usually the ones that are the most tasty. And again, are the most calorie dense ones. As far as like traveling too, do you try to stick with places that are like a certain time of the year in terms of weather, or do you kind of base your decision off that? Or is it just, again, where you guys are open to going during that time?
Mostly for sure. Research actually finds that of all the things we habituate to in terms of subjective well-being, the weather is not one of them. So sunlight consistently makes people happier and it keeps making people happier even in the long run. So I think it's whenever possible, like most people say, you know, everyone likes sun. And I think it is very valuable to have a good amount of sun in your life. And if not, you use daylight lamps with 10,000 lux. That also really helps to compensate. So most of the time I do spend in relatively warm, sunny areas. I don't like the heat so much. I'm actually relatively intolerant to heat. So air conditioning for me is a must. But I do love the sun, which means I spend most of my time in tropical areas. And when it's winter in Europe, I typically go to Asia or some other place. There have been, I think, almost 10 years of my life where I didn't even have a coat.
That's crazy. Yeah. So definitely I figured it was more usually I feel like when people travel like that and are nomads, I feel like they usually try to stick to places that are usually warmer. And I don't blame you. You know, it gets where I live, it gets pretty cold here in the winter. And man, I'll tell you what, I definitely notice a difference in terms of mood, you know, when it's cloudier and colder out and you can't really get outside. And I know that's, you know, that's probably why a lot of places, like for example, California, it's like such a popular place to go to and live and why it's so expensive to live there. You know, there's definitely mm-hmm. something to that for sure. But you said there is research to back up that, you know, being in the sun more leads to general happiness for most people.
Yep. And light therapy really works. So 10K lux light therapy with an artificial sun or a daylight lamp, whatever you want to call it, and vitamin D supplementation if needed, it really makes a difference.
Now, do you think that is because of the vitamin D, or is it just multiple reasons in terms of that? Is it maybe because we evolved like being outside and being in the sun, or what do you think? What are your thoughts on that?
No, the light exposure is a circadian rhythm effect.
Okay.
There's actually typically no UV light in these kind of lamps. So even though it's supposed to be full spectrum, it's not really full spectrum in that it doesn't have UV light like sunlight, so it won't get you a tan. It's not like a tanning kind of light. Although tanning has actually been found to make people happier as well. When people use a tanning booth, it actually has a significant measurable effect on their well-being as well. So that's I wouldn't be opposed to using that either. But the skin cancer risk is also real. So
right.
there's that to consider.
But yeah, sorry, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, so it's not the vitamin D that the daylight lamp operates under. The vitamin D is a separate mechanism, simply vitamin D depletion if you get no sunlight at all during the winter. That is also responsible for some of the more prolonged winter blues.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's really interesting because it's mostly circadian rhythm is what you said, but obviously vitamin D plays a role. But also with the tanning bed too, that is kind of funny, like you said though. Definitely make sure that, you know, there's obviously the skin cancer risk, but it's funny to hear that because I feel like pretty much all the time, you're going to hear negative things about tanning beds. So it is kind of interesting to hear something positive about it. So, but like you said, obviously, you know, there's still the risk of skin cancer. So, So obviously you told us where you're at now. So living in Portugal for the current time being, what about your back? I know that last time we had you on that was bothering you. But I did see recently on Instagram that you kind of gave everybody an update on it. And you did kind of mm-hmm. mention that it's a little bit worse than what you had thought.
Definitely. For one, it simply hasn't healed yet. And in fact, it's not really better than it was. It's better now than it was way at the start. I think what I'm currently doing is working slowly, very, very slowly. But yeah, it's not soft tissue. I thought it was a quadratus lumborum tear, which seemed to be the only thing that made sense to me and the physios I talked about, because there was an audible pop. It wasn't that severe, seemingly, in terms of pain and the like and functional restrictions. And it happened during dumbbell bench press. So I thought, yeah, with the pop and the pain location being clearly to the side of the spine, I thought, okay, should be soft tissue. Everyone pretty much that I talked to agreed. I mean, it might still be, but it doesn't show on the MRI. And what the MRI does show is at least one significantly herniated disc, and one below it's also slightly bulging. And then there's strong debate about whether L1, L2 is anteriorly herniated. I'm not quite sold on that. And even if that is true, I doubt it's responsible for my symptoms. But yeah, it just goes to show with these things, you get a million different opinions and there's almost no consensus. It's crazy how little consensus there is. Also, after my update, I got like 50 different unsolicited diagnoses from physios, all sorts of different professionals that Instagrammed me, Facebooked me, emailed me, people connected me to other people. And it's really completely all over the place. It's crazy how little, even of the most basic facts, like could a hernia be responsible for these symptoms? Zero consensus. Some people say, yes, all of your symptoms are typical. Other people say, no, these symptoms are literally impossible to have with a herniated disc. Yeah.
That's so that is crazy. Cause you're really, like you said, you're getting so many different opinions on it, and it does make you really think. Like, I mean, to me, that just tells me, hey, you definitely want to get at least a second opinion on injuries if something pops up. So
absolutely.
With all that information, then what are your next steps then? I mean, are you going to just keep trying to do what you've been doing and try to get better? Or do you kind of have a game plan there to, start to get better?
Yeah, my current method is much like the McGill method. So I'm doing his rehab drills with some modifications. And I'm mostly following his kind of setup where you're monitoring the amount of pain-freeness, especially for me, mornings are probably the best indicator. Because the one big difficulty for me is that almost nothing I do hurts unless it really makes it a lot worse. So when it's painful for me, I know it got a lot worse typically. And I only notice the next day, which is very, very difficult. So if I walk too much for one day, for example, then the next day I'll know it, but I won't know it during the day. So it's just everything is a very slow process where it's like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I do method A, and then, oh no, I did something wrong, and I'm back to square one. And then all I've learned, okay, cannot do this. And then again, another 3 weeks pass, and then, okay, cannot do this. And so very, very gradually, I'm moving towards being pain-free. Now I was actually pain-free for a few days. But now I found out that bird dogs, I cannot do bird dogs with straight legs. So pretty much any glute activity is a huge risk factor for me.
And you can't do bird dogs because of the injury or just your body type?
The injury. Yeah, it makes it worse. So whenever I do bird dogs with glute extension, so fully straightening the leg, as is typically instructed, which is funny because at the same time they say, look, you cannot move the pelvis or the spine when doing the bird dog. So you should stay fully tight, maintain your spinal brace, and then you fully extend the leg. It's like those things are literally mutually exclusive. It's impossible to fully flex the glute without moving the pelvis and probably also the spine to at least a few degrees.
Yeah. Wow. So that sounds frustrating just because, like you said, it's like, you don't get that like indicator right away. It takes, like you said, a day. So it's almost like you kind of have to wait and see. And then from there, it's like it just takes a little while to figure out what is bothering it, what isn't. I can definitely see where that can get very frustrating. So as far as like training goes, is that still kind of the same as last time, or have you switched that up, or are you not training at all right now?
A lot less. My volume is about a third, if I recall correctly, from where I was last time. My leg workouts are basically leg extensions, leg curls, calf raises. That's it. And the like spinal stabilization drills, so like bird dogs, but they're not nearly stimulating enough for me to gain muscle, maybe probably not even to retain it. And upper body, even anything remotely inducing spinal stresses is also out. So it's basically minimum effective volume, aiming for 6 sets per muscle group per week. So very, very low volume. And yeah, very controlled, great spinal stability during all exercises. And yeah, that seems to calm it down gradually. But yeah, it's a very slow process because one day if I stand too long, move too much, whatever, any daily life activity or I change an exercise even just a little bit, it can set me back another 2 weeks, and following the process, just gotta stick with it.
Yeah, I guess my question to you then off of that is, so you've cut down volume big time. I think, again, you know, research has shown that you can maintain, I mean, what you're doing now, like you said, is more MEV, so minimum effective. So you are seeing like some progress, just very small amounts. But the cool thing with that is like maintenance is a lot lower than what you would think it would be. And so I'm assuming you're probably using that to your advantage there. And I guess to follow that up, you know, how are you mentally about, are you feeling kind of frustrated with the process? Or are you more just like, hey, I'm just able to learn a little bit more about this, what's going on? Or yeah, I'm curious to hear how you kind of are mentally about everything going on.
There are always these moments where, especially every setback, you have to mentally reset because it really sucks. It's such a slow process. It's been since September. Yeah. And I've had maybe 20 pain-free days. So the pain I can deal with very well. I'm not I'm not too fussed about the pain, but as long as I knew for sure I was on the track where, okay, I'm going to recover as long as I just do this. For me, the biggest problem is all the setbacks and knowing or not knowing for sure, like, am I ever going to get over this? Because the timeline is already much worse than it's been for many individuals. So that's probably the worst part for me. And training-wise, I think I'm pretty good with mentally resetting. For example, first I had the phase where, okay, I'm going to try to keep my squat and deadlift strength up, like in September. And, well, that quickly went out the window. So I was like, okay, strength, not a priority for me. Just got to try to maintain my size. And then one next thing that I always tell my clients as well is, okay, if we can at least train all of your muscle groups with at least minimum effective volume, we're golden. You know, it will be a bit slower, but if we can rehab this and still get at least minimum effective volume in for all muscle groups, then we're doing well. You know, we're making progress. And the fact that we're not doing the exact exercise that we'd like to do, all of these things are relatively trivial. We can still make progress and move in the right direction and rehab this. But then now I'm also at a level where, yeah, that's definitely not going to happen, not for the erector spinae and the glutes at a minimum. So, okay, those are always also out, not the most important muscles. So again, we can live with that. And now the main thing is simply knowing, you know, is this going to be what I'm going to do the next year? Or at least I'm going to know if the next year I'm going to be better. Well, there's no way to tell. So I'm just going to have to stick with it and learn as much as possible from it and focus on other things in life.
Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, mentally it's obviously not easy for you, but it seems like overall you're in a pretty good spot here. But also, like you said, just kind of like being able to reset has been key for you in terms of like, hey, I'm going to, you know, keep my squat and bench up. And then obviously, like you said, now that wasn't able to work out. Now you're kind of resetting it to where it's like, okay, now I'm going to be able to keep up certain muscle groups. But I believe if I heard correctly, like glutes and like erector spinae are ones that you're not going to be able to keep up. So you're just kind of just basically just like, okay, that it is what it is. And now I got to work around this as best as I can. And then basically the mental part that you struggle with the most is just like not knowing when you're going to, the timeline of it basically, because like most injuries, I feel like other than like maybe a sprain, but even a sprain, you kind of, or a concussion too, I guess there's not really a timeline, but, or there is a timeline, but there's not for those. And so like, I could see where that's like probably the biggest thing that would mess with me mentally the most too, is just like not knowing when this is going to be over.
Yeah. Or if it's going to be over.
Or yeah. Even if it's going to be over. Right. Yeah. That too, because like you said, it could, hopefully not. Hopefully you get a good prognosis eventually here and things start to calm down. So you kind of mentioned pain too. Do you do anything specifically there to kind of reduce the pain that you feel during this time? Like, I don't know if like supplementing or nutrition wise or anything like that.
No, I'm actually deliberately including the pain. So I'm not taking any pain at all, because I think it's very important to stay sensitive to your pain signals. These are one of the only things you have. So, I mean, we have the imaging and I have pain signals, and that's pretty much it. Like other than this, what do you have to go by? Like, how do you know when to stop? If I was taking painkillers and I would just keep walking, I wouldn't feel anything. I mean, this is basically not, I didn't take painkillers, but that's the method I tried for the first 2 months, you know, the sort of modern pain science. Okay. Theoretically, this injury does not correspond with major tissue damage. So maybe it's a neural thing. Maybe it's muscle cramps. I actually tried even taurine supplementation at the start because I was like, yeah, this it doesn't make any sense. Maybe it's just cramps because it was in Mexico and, you know, you sweat a ton. So maybe electrolyte deficiency of some kind. Yeah, obviously didn't do anything. But that didn't help at all. Like just walking through the pain and ignoring it, which is a method that's often advocated, actually, especially when it comes to walking. But yeah, that didn't work at all. So I tried a few of these different methods. And for me, the MRI, at least, even if that's another big uncertainty, if the herniated disc is actually the cause of the symptoms, because it doesn't correspond with the original pain location, but then again, nothing does. So it's a weird injury for sure. But at least it excluded a lot of diagnoses. And it definitely made me realize, okay, yeah, this is really... or this could very well be a very significant structural issue that's going to last at least months and probably a year until it's rehabbed. So mindset-wise, it helped, and it also made me realize how important it is, or very well could be. And it excluded a lot of the other diagnoses that others had made, like a cordatus lumborum strain there. So, you know, even, of course, then there are still the people that say like, yeah, but maybe it doesn't show on the MRI. Well, it's at least not a fully torn off cordatus lumborum, because that you would definitely see.
Right.
So it definitely, I think, helps more than some people now give it credit for.
Yeah. So with that was interesting with the pain, like you said, you're not taking anything because you do want to be, you know, in touch with your pain. And like you said, what I got out of that was like, you didn't want to take anything because you want to make sure that like it's getting better and you're not like out of touch with what's going on to where it's like, you could potentially make it worse. Is that kind of.
Exactly. And I think for many strength trainees, one of the most important things with injuries, I think, and one of the biggest gaps that thwarts a lot of public debate is between physios that have experience with strength trainees and physios that do not work with strength trainees. And that is a world of difference. So if you have an individual, like my parents currently, or my father has knee problems. Now, probably one of the best things he can do is just to be as active as possible, because he doesn't train or anything. So he just needs to walk a lot. And if painkillers help him walk more, it's probably going to be net beneficial for him, because just the active recovery, the fact that he's doing something, is more important than anything else. Now, for most strength trainees that have something like a real tissue damage injury or overuse injury, pain is one of the most important things to listen to. If they start walking through pain, many of my hardcore clients, if I tell them, just push for a little pain, they're just going to make it worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. So really just kind of getting, you know, taking the individual person into account, and, you know, it's what they need. Like you said, somebody that strength trains, they need to probably rest, like you said, whereas like somebody like your father who has knee pain, he probably needs to continue to stay active and move. And mm-hmm. if you just give a kind of one size fits all approach, you know, that's, you're going to run into some issues there. What about the nutrition? Have you changed anything on that side? Like, are you going through any phases, or are you just kind of keeping your calories around like maintenance during this time?
Yeah, maintenance, main gaining, I would say. Like, I mean, such a lean bulk with barely any energy surplus is sort of the idea. Recently did a shortcut, which also didn't seem to help the recovery process, but I need to get some fat off. So now I'm just sort of main gaining a lot lower calorie intake, because of the volume reduction. And I'm not doing, you know, squats, deadlifts, these big kind of compound lifts, a lot of machine work. So my energy expenditure in the gym is measurably reduced as well.
Yeah, that's, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, a lot of people think that their calories are going to be this fixed number, but it's like, you know, that can change over time. Like you said, you're not doing as many squats and compound movements, you're doing more machine work, but I mean, also probably even just like movement as well, right? Where it's like mm-hmm. overall movement's probably down, because you said even sometimes if you move too much, that can bother your back. So probably overall movement's down a little bit as well, which is going to, you know, probably have a pretty significant impact on your metabolic rate, especially with somebody like you that has, you know, a lot of muscle on your body. So all that little bit's going to add up. And you said you cut for a little bit, and you said that wasn't really great for your recovery.
No, it didn't really seem. I did a 2-week cut, and yeah, there was no progress during that time, whereas there should have been. And using similar methods the next week, there was. So, I mean, I'm right now, I think I'm still at the stage of the sort of initial healing, trying to get pain free, to, you know, at least wake up pain free, which I'm now almost at again. And it's very, very delicate. I think overall, people probably overestimate the effect of nutrition on healing, especially when these kind of serious injuries, because the body prioritizes its nutrients quite well. Just like if you go into energy deficit, it's not like your body will catabolize the heart and the brain and vital organs. There's actually good research on organ prioritization of the human body and its organ sparing tendencies. And strength training essentially puts muscle tissue at the organ level, or a little under it, in terms of what it does with it in energy deficits. So it tries to still spare it. And that's why you're able to lose mostly or even exclusively fat when you go into energy deficit and you have a properly set up training program. So I think many people think oh, I cannot heal if I'm not in energy surplus. Yeah, fortunately, that's not the case, because if you think of the awful hospital foods most people get, I think the vast majority of people in the hospital are in an energy deficit, especially bigger people, because they all get the same food, right? It's crazy how bad hospital food is.
Yeah, no, that is a really good point you bring up. Your body is going to be really good at prioritizing like what it needs to do. And so, no, that makes a lot of sense. And like you said too, with the hospital food, yeah, that food, yeah, I don't know about that. And then like you, even on the fact too, that I'm assuming what you were talking about there were the serving sizes, right? I mean, the serving sizes are going to be the same for somebody that's 275 pounds and probably 130 pounds, right? I mean, is that kind of what you're alluding? Yeah, that's what I figured. Yeah. Cool. So basically, like you said, I mean, just be careful. Like basically people overestimate the role of nutrition when it comes to injury. Again, your body's going to do a really good job at prioritizing those things on its own. Cool. So hopefully next time we chat, your back is almost fully healed. You know, I know that you've been dealing with this for a while, so I hope that, you know, I know you're working hard to get back to normal. So I hope that, you know, things start to head in that direction here soon. Cool. So I want to kind of, let's go to the next thing I wanted to chat about with you was, are there any new either nutrition or fitness or really any other studies out there that are either coming out or that have recently come out that you have found to be super interesting? You pick maybe like one or two or something like that, whatever you think is necessary for the audience to hear.
Sure. Today, I can talk about the study I looked at today, which was, I read the EPUB before, but it's a new study from Townsend et al. And they looked at dietary nitrate supplementation in the form of red spinach extract, which falls under the no booster category, the nitric oxide booster kind of supplements along with citrulline. And they found no beneficial effects at all. And they measured body composition, strength development, power outputs. They were concurrent athletes, Division I baseball players. So doing strength and endurance training, essentially, which should be a pretty ideal scenario for nitrite. And yeah, no effects, and also no effects on health markers like blood pressure and heart rate. Because some people, they say like, okay, well, if it doesn't, you know, improve my gains, at least it's very good for my heart. But in reality, it's probably too short-lived to have a meaningful impact on things like your total average daily blood pressure, because even if you take nitrates and even if they do significantly decrease your blood pressure, it's such a transient effect that over 24 hours, it's not that meaningful. Like your with blood pressure reading, for example, we see quite clearly that a single reading is not as predictive as a 24-hour reading.
Interesting. So what's kind of the general consensus on dietary nitrates? Because I feel like that's sort of a newer kind of supplement that people have kind of been, I guess this is dietary nitrates though, but I know this is kind of a newer thing that people have kind of been talking about a little bit more lately. So what's kind of the general consensus? Do you, is this kind of more in line with what you think with it, or is this something that's kind of changed your opinion on them?
I think it's in line with what I think, but not in line with the consensus. Well, maybe not consensus, but there are quite a lot of people who advocate for nitrate. I think examine.com is pretty hyped on them, for example. I think in general, they may be slightly overly positive about supplements. But also, I think the Stronger by Science guys, who I think are absolutely awesome, they have also advocated, I think. Eric Helms is on board. So most of the most esteemed professionals are, I think, the nitric oxide booster category of supplements as a whole is very promising and worth taking for at least some individuals. So this study definitely cast some doubt on that, on the relevance of the effects. I think in particular, you know, most of the research shows it can acutely enhance performance, but then we're still a step away from removed from what people really care about. Because if you just go to the gym and you can take a supplement and it makes you do a few more reps in the gym, I think not many people will really care about that. You know, if you do 12 or 13 reps of biceps curls, that's not really worth paying for. What you want is that extra performance translates into greater biceps growth or strength development. Now, that is definitely a leap, because normally you would think, okay, there is a correlation between work output and gains, like the long-term muscular development and the acute performance. However, in the case of nitric oxide boosters, the main benefit is vasodilation, so basically improving blood flow. And we know that hypoxia, which is kind of the opposite, restricting oxygen, and the blood flow restriction training, which is very much the opposite of improving blood flow, they actually improve muscle growth, if anything, in research. So the idea of any of these kind of metabolic stress buffers is very theoretically shaky, because metabolic stress itself is not detrimental. It's actually, for muscle growth purposes, beneficial in the sense of peripheral neuromuscular fatigue, especially in the form of metabolic stress, lowers the activation threshold of the high threshold motor units. So it basically increases muscle activity when you start getting fatigued. And by virtue of that, KATSU training, like blood flow restriction training, can make light weights as effective as heavier weights. So the extra performance you get is sort of a reverse KATSU effect, which would probably mean it's not going to be beneficial, because it's not really making the muscle work harder. It's just enabling it to do more work for a given level of neuromuscular effort.
Interesting. So it almost sounds like it's like increasing like work capacity in a way, or am I not understanding?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's kind of increasing work capacity, but basically you can just like do more now, and that's really it, right? It's not like necessarily going to add a ton of gains. You're just going to be able to do a little bit more there. With
yeah.
That.
So probably not, based on this study and the only other study we have, which is Wang et al. From 2018, they found no difference on long-term gains from citrulline in the previous study's case, and in this study from nitrite, or red spinach extract specifically. Now, both studies were not super highly dosed, but this dose, which I think was 180 milligrams of nitrite, which was 2 grams of red spinach extract, if I'm not mistaken, this was enough to increase nitric oxide levels in previous research. So it was definitely enough to do something physiologically. You could say, okay, maybe you just need more to get better gains. I'm never really sold on that argument so much, because if there's not at least a trend for some benefits at a lower dose, I'm very skeptical of if we're suddenly going to see magic with higher doses. You know, you can basically always make that argument, like, oh, you just need more.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, if you're not going to see a lot from a little bit, it's like, is it really going to make that big of a difference if you start to just take like an obscene amount of that, whatever that may be? Cause it's like, I mean, at what point is it like, okay, plus even from like a practicality standpoint too, I'm assuming, where it's just like, how much is actually practical for you to actually do anyways?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. It reminds me a bit of the pharmaceutical industry's argument during the opioid crisis, where they started making these painkillers and people got addiction symptoms. And then they came out with the rhetoric that the symptoms they got were because people weren't taking enough painkillers. So rather than saying, okay, these are the withdrawal and addiction symptoms, they were saying, no, look, what's happening is you're not giving them enough. Therefore, they're still symptomatic. So you should give them more.
Yeah, just give them more.
Yeah, and of course the manufacturers, they love that argument.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what they wanted to hear. That was music to their ears, because then that's, you know, obviously more money in their pocket. So what about on your end? Do you have any studies that you're coming out with soon, or you're involved in, or anything like that?
I'm still working on the fasting study.
Okay.
That's been massively delayed during the pandemic. I think that will be late this year that we can hopefully start wrapping that up. Other than that, I'm mostly spending time on my PT course at the moment. So doing a lot of updates on that. And after that launches in late August, I'm going to have time again to take on some new projects.
Awesome. Yeah. We'll obviously link the PT course in the show notes as well. So cool. All right. Are you ready to dive into some questions?
Sure.
Cool. So one of the questions I got was, what protein targets you would set in a deficit versus a surplus?
The same, actually. I think the current research does not show differences in protein requirements between energy deficit and surplus. I had a very long debate with Eric Helms about this on my website. You can still find it. It's pretty dated now. But briefly, in untrained individuals, we very clearly have research showing that protein requirements do not change in energy deficits versus surplus. So what we'd be looking at is a three-way interaction between training status, protein requirements, and energy balance, which in itself, you could already say, if you're a scientist or a physicist, you can say that as soon as you're anyone's talking about a three-way interaction, you should be skeptical because these things are incredibly rare in nature. But okay, it's possible. Maybe energy balance does change protein requirements specifically for strength trainees. There's no research actually showing that protein requirements are higher than the 1.8 gram per kilogram, which I typically recommend for most trainees, regardless of energy balance. So we kind of have to go by some cross-sectional comparisons, which is a little shaky. And the only other thing we have is just long after that debate, I think only maybe this year or no, it was the last year, I think, a study was actually done that looked at least protein requirements per meal to maximize muscle protein synthesis at a given sitting, both post-workout and fasted, if I'm not mistaken. And they found that the dose commonly used, which I think is 0.3 gram per kilogram of body weight, that maximizes protein synthesis in states of energy maintenance or surplus, is still sufficient to maximize it in energy deficit. So that provides decent evidence that protein requirements are probably indeed the same in energy deficit and surplus, even in trained lifters.
Interesting. Yeah. So I think there too, I mean, my thought on it is like, I feel like that could just add a lot of confusion as well. If you're like, okay, well now I'm in a surplus. So now I need to add or do either add, or I would imagine most people's probably thought process would be they would do less, they would eat less protein in a surplus than in a deficit. I could just see a lot of confusion there. What about like, what are your thoughts on increasing protein slightly, like during a surplus, because you might get a little bit more protein through like kind of like trace proteins, right? Like say, for example, you eat a lot of like carbohydrates, like oats or some rice, right? And you know, some of that protein will add up. Is there any merit to potentially increasing that a little bit because of that? Or I'm curious to hear your thoughts there.
Yeah, that's actually a good argument against the idea that you need more protein in deficits, because typically when you're cutting, you have your protein intake is going to take up a larger share of your calories. So you're going to have more of that. That's going to be chicken breast and, you know, high quality protein sources, as opposed to say cereals, rice, and other foods you may consume during a bulk. So your average protein quality is probably higher on average in energy deficit than energy surplus, which would further counteract the practical need to increase protein intakes. Now, we could take that argument the other way, as you say, and say, okay, maybe in energy surplus, we actually need more protein to offset the potential decrease in protein quality. Now, most research, it actually has a somewhat eloquent solution to that. And they say that the protein requirements that they're looking at and what most research is based on is given with the assumption that at least 50% of the total protein intake comes from high quality sources. So as long as you make sure that you're still getting that, I think you won't get into trouble. And more practically, even simpler speaking, I'd say if you're getting your protein target every meal and every meal has a high quality protein source, regardless of amount, I think it will almost never be an issue, because you almost never see anyone eat, you know, 30 grams of chicken breast or something. Yeah, that's simply not a practical portion size. So as soon as you're eating chicken breast, you're eating at least 100 grams. Well, it's 20 grams. That's most likely going to be more than half of what you need for that meal. So yeah, I think in practice, it is not going to be an issue.
Right. Yeah. And it's that makes a lot of sense. You really don't need to make too big of changes. I guess really it probably just comes down to, you know, you kind of have your, I think you said your recommendation was 1.8, which is what, that's around like 0.8, 0.9 grams for pounds, I believe, right?
0.82 gram per pound. Yep.
Okay. And I'm assuming probably preference probably plays a role in this too, right? But as far as like, if somebody does like to eat a little bit more protein, you know, obviously you'll go a little bit higher if they want, but if not, then you don't really have to change it from a deficit to a surplus.
Exactly. It's a minimum. So there's no need to, you know, some people say they get sort of offended and they say, well, I like protein. And they always reply, okay, great. You know, fine. It's essentially just a positive message. You don't need that much protein. So if you want to eat more protein, fine, go ahead. But other people maybe don't like it. And it gives them more options, more variety, and makes it easier for them to consume a diet that they're happy with and they can stick to. Plus, I think that once you've been sort of almost brainwashed with, and I certainly have been, with the need for super high protein intakes, your sort of internal menu of what you consider as a practical meal decreases. So you have a much more limited scope of what kind of foods you can make. And if you know that your protein intake is not that large, then some other foods are certainly going to be an option. For example, cheese. For many people, cheese is not a practical protein source because it's relatively caloric compared to how much protein it has. But it does have quite some protein. And if you have eggs with cheese, for example, or maybe fatty kind of meat, if you notice your protein intake isn't that high, then you can potentially fit those in. So you don't just have to live on white fish and chicken breast and 0% fat beef and the like.
No, that's a really good point you bring up. And that's one thing too that I've definitely looked at cheese. I'm like, man, you know, if you actually look at cheese, I mean, I think one serving's like 6 to 10 grams of fat, but it's also about 8 grams of protein, I believe. What are your thoughts on like dropping that down to potentially doing like a lower fat version or reduced fat version of that? I'm just kind of curious to hear your thoughts mm-hmm. on that, if that's kind of a viable option for some people to do that with like cheese.
Definitely. I mean, cottage cheese is the best example of that. It's still cheese, and that's a super lean cheese. And in Brazil, I've seen cheeses which have about 20 gram protein, 1 gram fat, and almost no carbs. So it's like chicken breast. And it's white cheese. It almost has the taste of chicken breast as well, i.e. none. But at least in terms of texture and its ease of being able to mix it into a meal, it's pretty awesome that it at least exists. And I think for a lot of people, especially when they're bulking, they can actually spice up their meals a lot more with some fattier kinds of options than just, you know, always going for the lean options. It's funny, actually, a lot of people that have always done high carb, low fat diets, when they start doing a high fat diet, they will very often come to me and say, look, it's how do I get this much fat in? Like, this is ridiculous. I feel like I'm going to have to drink olive oil. And I look at their diet and it's like, okay, so you're consuming Greek yogurt, which has all the fat removed. You're consuming 0% beef, which is beef with all the fat removed. And you're consuming the leanest cuts of the chicken. And you're consuming only lean pieces of fish, but you can't consume more fat. And then they're like, okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's really a good point you bring up. I mean, if you really want to, you can definitely increase your fats. And when I'm going from like a cut to more of a surplus, like, you know, cheese is definitely something that I'll definitely start to add in a little bit more. But like I said, I've also used like reduced fat and low fat cheese, and that really can increase your protein intake there. And like you said, you don't have to just stick to, like you said, chicken breast and like fish and stuff like that. You have options out there. I heard you kind of mention that you were kind of brainwashed with all the protein talk. What are your preferences with protein? Are you more of a higher protein guy, or like in terms of, obviously we know for body comp, we want a certain amount of protein, but if that wasn't necessarily an issue, where are your preferences at with protein?
I wouldn't consume nearly that much for sure. I mean, I like quark and Greek yogurt, dairy in general. So I'd continue eating those, but they're not that rich in protein. You know, you need to eat quite a lot of them, which is fine for me, but I'd probably eat more eggs and chicken breast. I mean, does anyone really like chicken breast? I think it's fine. You can make it flavorful, but in itself, it doesn't have that much taste. So if I didn't have to consume any protein at all yet, that will definitely reduce my protein intake.
That's how I am too. I'm just, if I don't like actually track my protein, and if I didn't have to eat a lot of protein, I would definitely lean more towards, you know, lower protein for sure. Cause I'm just, like you said, I'm not a huge fan of chicken breasts. And, I always just find that if I just kind of eat more intuitively, I'm more like lower protein for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's the case for most people. We have clear research showing that people's food preferences and brain reward pathway activation and the hormonal release after they've consumed meals is typically all errs in favor of fats and carbs over protein.
Yeah. And it makes sense. I think that's going to be a little bit, the palatability of that's going to be a little bit higher with the carbs mm-hmm. and the fats. So it makes sense. Let's go on to the next one. So your opinion and method for deloading, they said they listened to Coach Kasim and Dr. Mike on Revive Stronger. So they just wanted to kind of hear your opinion on deloading, what that looks like.
I'm a proponent of reactive deloading typically rather than proactive. So the main advantage of a reactive deload over what's called a proactive deload, most people don't call it that, but it is. If you, for example, just take a week off, or you take a week where you train very lightly, you cut the volume in half or the weights in half. Those are typical approaches. The downsides of that is that A, you never know for sure when you need the deload. So I think a lot of people deload too much. And for example, 1 week off every 4 weeks or every three weeks on, 1 week off, that is a lot of deloading. That's 25% of your time that you're not training. So that's a lot. You know, even if we're saying I can just create a program so that you can keep training, and we assume that your gains are linear over time, you can get 25% more gains just from skipping the deloads. So that is very significant. And then B, even if you do need a deload, you probably don't need one for the whole body. For example, if you're prone to overusing your elbows, as I am, then that doesn't mean you should deload your hips. Because, for example, for me, my hips never have issues. So, and many people have that. Everyone has some weaker joints and some stronger joints, and they're typically fine with banging on volume just pretty much nonstop for very long periods, indefinitely in many cases. They never have issues with certain joints. So injury-wise, they don't need it. And certain muscle groups also, like the glutes, there are many women who train their glutes every single session, never have any issues with it. Glutes in general seem to tolerate it pretty well. So, you know, when you're deloading your knees or your quads, maybe the glutes don't need it. And that is a big difference. So combine the two main benefits of being able to deload only specific body parts or muscle groups or exercises, and deloading when you feel you really need it, like when your performance shows it's starting to decline or it's not increasing as expected, then you could do a reactive deload and just skip that exercise or skip the volume for that muscle group or body part. I think it's much more targeted than, you know, the blanket week off.
Yeah, so yours is a little bit more, like you said, it's you know, like you said, it's not, we don't call it a proactive deload, but proactive would be like, hey, every, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, you're taking a deload week, no matter what's going on, that's pretty much when it's going to be. But for you, you kind of like the more reactive, because it's more so when you need it. And you kind of mentioned some things there. What would be some other kind of like indicators that you would need to take one outside of, like you said, training performance was one that if that's not going up, what are some other things you kind of like pay attention to that like, oh damn, okay, I definitely need to take a deload week here now.
I think performance is by far the number one, and probably the main issue with need for deloads is that people look at irrelevant indicators more so than they're not looking at enough indicators. So a lot of people will say, and I see this all the time in clients, especially people that aren't as motivated, they will say, I fear that I'm overreaching. And then I tell them, okay, you're making great strength gains, which by definition precludes any definition of overreaching or overtraining. Many people don't realize that, scientifically speaking, regression of performance is the first and foremost criterion of overreaching and overtraining. You cannot have it. You can be overtraining if you're making progress, because that means you're not just recovering, you're super compensating. And the whole idea of overreaching, overtraining is that you're not recovering. So these things completely exclude each other. And many people, they look at motivation or pain. Now, injuries are definitely a reason to potentially take, to reduce the volume, but there are many more effective methods to keep training and still get that productive volume in without aggravating a certain injury, higher reps, control tempo, different exercises, changing technique. So I think for many people, they mistake their like slight pains or fatigue as a need to deload, when in reality, what I find is very often the case is that you're just stressed in general, or you haven't slept enough, or there's something else entirely that's causing them to not feel as good. And another general tendency, I think, is that many lifters, they're serious about their training. We massively overestimate how big of an influence our training and our nutrition has on our daily life. The influence is much, much stronger the other way. So how your general life goes, how happy you are, has a much bigger effect on your training than the effect of, you know, how many sets of biceps curls you're doing, the effect on your overall happiness level.
Right. And my understanding, too, of the research is that it's really hard to like overtrain per se from like weight training. It's probably more so people are not getting in enough like energy. That was my understanding of kind of the research. I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on that or if that's kind of in line with what you see as well.
Yeah. Any such criteria are always secondary to regression of performance.
Yeah. What about like you mentioned that like performance is pretty much like you're not the main thing you want to pay attention to, but you kind of briefly touched on like motivation, but would low motivation constitute a deload in your mind, even though it's not necessarily like a physical thing? What do you think there?
No, I don't think so. I think in most cases it doesn't solve the problem at all. It's like a diet break. Research shows it does not aid adherence overall. It just puts it on hold. So any problems that you're facing, you're still going to face them next week, whether it's a deload week or a diet break or whatever it is. So unless you're training for like a contest prep or you're doing something unsustainable, maybe your training volume is deliberately pushed up to a level that you know you're not going to do for life, then I get it. But otherwise, if you're just doing what should be a manageable program, you're not feeling motivated, then you should address that. And we need to look at, okay, what factors? Is it the lack of progression, which is a big one, I think? Or is there something else? Like in my experience, it's very often sleep or stress or something else in their life that they then project onto their training rather than that it really is something related to the training itself.
Yeah. So looking at outside factors, and I'm assuming too, like maybe even switching up, like, so really for you, like if you have a client that is like unmotivated, it's more so, hey, we're looking at things like you said, sleep, you know, okay, are you progressing in your workouts? You know, sleep and stress, like you said, those are going to play a huge role in terms of how you feel about your training. Would this warrant potentially like a change up in like maybe even like rep ranges or like exercises as well then at that point, potentially?
You could, yeah. If it's boredom in particular. I have some clients that say, look, I've been on this program for like a few months now. Even though it's still working as intended, I'm just bored as hell. I can't stand another session of front squats. I have to do something else. And then we can say, okay, so, you know, which exercises are you really bored with? Well, because maybe, you know, they still love the butterfly lateral raises or the lat prayers. And then we keep those in and we switch out what they're unhappy with, or we introduce some variety for the sake of it. Sometimes just, you know, if even a few different sessions can have a big impact. For example, we could do 1RM testing if it's into that as a more kind of an maybe with post-activation potentiation, just for a little different workouts. And in the process, also get a benchmark of their 1RM strength, which can be useful for benchmarking performance later on. So yeah, then you just have to play around and go with what the individual likes, doesn't like, and what kind of variation they would prefer.
Right. So just kind of feel it out and everything like that. So that's where you would start to make some changes in terms of programming and whatnot. So this was a different question, but it kind of goes off of it. Are deload sessions necessary, or could like a session at like 3 or 4 RAR session provide similar benefits?
A deload's not necessary for sure. I mean, you can theoretically at least design programs so that you don't do any deloading, reactive or proactive. I think reactive is very, very prudent to have in there, because you never know if someone's going to have stress in their life, if they're not going to sleep as well, if their diet's not going to be as on point, if they drink alcohol. So it's very hard, I think, not to have any kind of deloading mechanism in place, because it's just hard to control for all of these things. Then next question is, do you really need to skip the sets? Now, what I typically do with a reactive deload is I do speed work. So I cut the weight a lot to maybe 60% of 1RM or up to 80% of 1RM, but then I only have them do 3 reps. So they should be very explosive reps. And I find that achieves A, the need to still move, A, B, some energy expenditure, C, still some technique training, and D, still some neuromuscular training, like speed work can aid strength development in certain contexts, like the West Side kind of method, without inducing much neuromuscular fatigue. Now, I think it's very difficult to go if you're not doing speed work or just taking sets off, but you're just taking it a bit easier, to find that sweet spot, because there are many people who, in my experience, they will still go too hard, and then you're, especially with injuries, you very easily get into a situation where you're not training hard enough to really make progress, but you are training hard enough so that you're not recovering. And like I said, with injuries in particular, I see this a lot, where most people's intuition is to just stay a few more reps away from failure. Or if they have knee pain while squatting, they will squat light. And my recommendation then is almost always, at least for the beginning, just stop squatting, because you're not going to gain any muscle with 50% of your normal weight, but it's still going to aggravate your knees. So you have kind of a worst of both worlds scenario then.
Yeah, I remember on our last podcast, you did talk about that with your injury, where it's like you have to be careful there, because like you said, you get the worst of both worlds, where you're not fully recovered, but you're also not going, you're not creating any adaptation or anything like that. So just, you're just, like you said, it's the worst of both worlds. Cool. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And so if we have time, I think this one will be super quick, so I don't think it will take too long for you to answer it. And then we'll wrap things up. Best body fat percentage for powerlifting in the off season.
Well, that depends a lot on your weight class and where your current weight is in relation to your weight class. I think for powerlifters, you have a lot of leeway, and it also depends on personal preference. That said, I wrote an article a long time ago, a very long time ago, called Critical Mass. And in that, the main thesis I propose is that many powerlifters have an excessively high body fat percentage to be competitive. Because if you just look at the research and the effects of body fat and muscle mass, then muscle mass correlates extremely strongly with powerlifting performance, like extremely strongly, to the extent that, and a recent study even did this, if you put powerlifters in a DEXA scanner or some body composition scanner, then their rankings of fat-free mass are going to be pretty much identical to their competition rankings. Like, you could basically forego the competition and just rank them by muscularity. So what can we do with that information? Well, if we cut out all the fat and you're basically pure muscle, then you have a huge competitive advantage over people that are at a similar weight, but have a lot of fat on them as well. So I think most powerlifters, they massively overestimate the importance of their total strength. So they're not willing to diet down, even if they lose some strength. But you have to think of your Wilk score, your IPF powerlifting score. And if you're really competitive, you keep that in mind, you'll see that you're actually very often best off. Now, maybe you don't want it, but like, if you're going from a purely competitive standpoint, then you're probably best off being pretty shredded, if not like bodybuilding shredded. Like, it really can make a very, very big difference in your relative strength level.
Well, that makes sense, because I feel like you would, because it's going to depend on, I believe, I'm not super familiar with powerlifting, but it's based off of like weight. And so like, if you can get lower in a weight class, but you're also like, most of your weight is muscle, like, you're going to put yourself an advantage in that group is what you're
exactly
saying.
Yeah.
And that's kind of counterintuitive, I feel like, to like the, again, I'm not like super in depth or in tune with powerlifting and what goes on with it, but my kind of like perception from the outside is that it's like, oh, you can eat whatever you want. You can, you know, you get as big as you want. And it's like, is that really the best way to go about it though? So what you're saying is, I mean, almost, it sounds like 10 to 15-ish percent, maybe even lower than 50% is probably around that range, maybe even lower than 10%. Or would you start to think that you would potentially start to lose some strength from being lower?
I mean, even if you lose strength going from 20 to 10%, which if you're a highly competitive powerlifter, you probably will, it's worth it. Now, below 10%, it gets dubious. And a great analogy, I think, here is sprinting. With sprinting, it's well known that being super lean is good for performance, gymnastics as well. And that's because the outcome measure itself directly shows that you're getting improvements. And with powerlifting, you don't see it. It's like if you were sprinting on a force plate, then the force plate would show, as you lose a lot of body weight, that you're probably outputting less force. And then you think, oh, damn. But you can see in your sprints, you're faster. And that's what matters. And with powerlifting, you don't see that your Wilk score improves. You just see that you're lifting less. And therefore, people think, it's like they're only looking at the force plate. Yeah. They think, you know, oh, this is not good. I need to, you know, keep my size, because otherwise I lose strength. But you need to do the math and think, is it worth being in a weight class with, and then compare your numbers to the people in that weight class. And then you see, okay, if I lose 5 kilo on my squat, but I'm in a weight class that's 10 kilo lighter, it's for sure going to be beneficial.
It almost sounds like it's the person that like is so worried about their body weight that they forget to realize that, like, okay, maybe you're going to be a little bit heavier body weight, but you're going to have like more muscle, right? It almost sounds like it's that you're just so focused on one aspect of it that you're not like thinking big picture with everything there.
Exactly.
I also wonder too, if like, you know, somebody like you take sprinters, I wonder if like genetically, you know, they can stay leaner, but still stay strong at those like leaner body fat percentage, and that, and it's just a genetic thing that obviously makes them like just be outliers and like, you know, really good at what they're doing. I'm assuming that probably plays a massive role in that.
Yeah, it plays more of a role because it's known that you have to be lean. So in powerlifting, it probably plays the same role, but it's not as well known because powerlifters typically don't get as shredded as sprinters or bodybuilders.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Menno, another great episode as always. Hopefully we can get you back on here in a couple months and finish up these questions. But yeah, I think that's enough information for now. And so before I let you go, is there anything, you kind of mentioned your PT course. I don't know if there's anything coming out that you want to lead the audience to.
No, if you're not familiar with my work, you can go to MennoAnsemos.com. And then probably best way is to get on my email newsletter because you get a tour of my most popular contents and things that I think most people enjoy the most. And otherwise, you know, I'm very active on social media and I'm planning to be more active. So hope to see you there.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll link all that. And I know you had two articles. I believe you had the critical mass, I think was one you said, right? That was the name of one article. And then...
Yeah, it's paid though. I think it's...
That's a paid one. Okay.
Yeah.
And then you had the article with Eric Helms. Is that also a paid one as well?
That's available for free. The debates I had. If you Google Henselmans Helms, you'll probably get it.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll link those as well in there. So again, Menno, thank you for your time and we will talk to you soon.
My pleasure. Talk soon.
Thank you for listening. If you want more free content like this, follow me on Instagram at jeffh91_ or visit jhhealth.net. See you next time.